Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. We'll get back to our discussion on cinema symbolism in just a moment. And a reminder, at the bottom of the hour, we'll open the phone lines for your questions and comments for Robert W. Sullivan IV. A Texas woman vacationing in Iceland had quite the misadventure when she sat on a small throne-shaped iceberg for a photo and promptly got swept out to sea. And you can read about the entire bizarre incident and see the pictures as well in the Highlight Carousel, where Sean Latasore has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back with Robert W. Sullivan. We'll discuss the amazing subtext of The Wizard of Oz right here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert W. Sullivan IV stays with us, and he has written two volumes on cinema symbolism. And Robert, you must have had a field day with The Wizard of Oz. It's just chock-a-block of esoteric meaning.
Well, that's right. The man who wrote The Wizard of Oz was L. Frank Baum, and he was a member of Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy Society. His wife was as well. And when you're dealing with The Wizard of Oz, you're really dealing with symbolism on three levels. And this is one of why it's one of my favorite movies to talk about and analyze. Was, you know, because there's just so much going on inside that film. On the one hand, you have it just being a simple story. You know, a girl who gets swept away by a tornado, goes to a magical land, has an adventure, confronts the wizard, defeats the witch, goes home, happy ending, have a nice day. This is, you know, what you would call your profane explanation, your on the surface explanation. But then you look deeper at it, and you have really two deeper storylines going on embedded in The Wizard of Oz. One is a little more well-known than the other one, and one is the first of the esoteric imagery is the political allegory of The Wizard of Oz. And then the second one is what I call sort of initiation into the mystery tradition, initiation into Gnosis for Dorothy. The political one is really, that one's a little more well known. The Wizard of Oz is a microcosm of essentially 1895 to 1900 political, economic, socio life in the United States of America, where you had a depression in 1896. People were laid off. You have the foreclosure of the farmlands. This is the farmhouse being swept away by the tornado. You have Dorothy walking on the golden pathway there, the yellow brick road that leads to Emerald City. This is symbolizing something called the gold standard. The Wizard of Oz would be William McKinley. He wanted to replace paper money. He wanted to use the gold standard to back paper money. This is why the yellow brick road leads to the Emerald City, which is green paper money. Think on that, those terms. The scarecrow is the farmer, the American farmer. The tin man would be the American laborer who, again, was laid off during this economic depression in 1896. When they meet Tin Man, he can't move. He's immobile. And to get him working, you have to oil him up. This is a reference to the oil companies like Rockefeller Standard Oil that employed a lot of laborers and got the laborer out of the depression by employing him. So the Tin Man has to be oiled up by Rockefeller, essentially, to get him back to work, to get him working again. Then you have the Cowardly Lion. This would be all bark, no bite. These are the political challengers to McKinley, Eugene Debs, the socialist, or Williams Jennings Bryan, the Democrat. Both were all loud bark, no bite. They were both defeated by McKinley twice. So we have the political allegory going on inside The Wizard of Oz. That one's a little more well-known. But then you have the idea of Baum incorporating this neo-Gnostic Madame Blavatsky esoteric thread in the movie. And it's clearly there. For example, with Dorothy, she gets taken up the tornado to the magical land. This would be Ascension. This is climbing the ladder of Mithras, climbing the ladder of Minerva, walking up the winding staircase of Freemasonry, Solomon Temple, to go to the middle chamber to receive wisdom. And then she's transported to this magical land, and she walks on the golden path of religion. This is sort of a Gnostic warning that leads to the Demiurge. This is the false god of you know, the god of the material world, as it were, in Gnosticism. This is sort of a warning from Baum to basically say, you know, beware of the god of the Abrahamic faith, you know, to be cautious of it. And you know, it's the golden path that leads to the, you know, the unruly Messiah, as it were. And then one of the things that Blavatsky talked about was to receive gnosis, to receive conscious awakening, is that you need fortitude, you need intelligence, and you need strength. You know, think the three travelers, one seeks a brain, one seeks a heart, one seeks courage. This is why they're joining up with Dorothy to help her on her mystical quest. To really know thyself, which was one of the purposes of Gnosticism, you know, is to have conscious awareness of who you are. And then, of course, she does eventually at the very end. She has her awakening. She has her Gnostic epiphany, which is for her that there's no place like home. And then she clicks her heel three times. Three is a magical number. I can't even begin to get into the symbolism of that. And then she's transported back to Kansas. And at the very end, it's teaching you this morality lesson, that she's much more conscious, she's much more aware of who she is and what she's been on. No one else, the farmhands don't understand her anymore. And this is tipped off a little bit in the movie, this esoteric. I mean, I like it how in the movie with Glinda, the good witch, she has the pentagram on her wand, but she has the 1 point up and the 2 points down. That's white magic. When the 2 points are up and the 1 point's down, that's black magic. She has the 1 point up, so she's the good guy. And this is in the book, and this also turns up in the movie, is the two evil witches are the East and West. That's really critical to this. That's stagnation. You move up and down the ladder of wisdom, up and down the steps, up and down the staircase, but moving northward and southward. The two positive witches who are trying to help Dorothy on her quest for Gnosis are the North and South, symbolizing this. The two witches of the East and West are the black magicians. They want to keep her stagnant. They want to keep her not achieving Gnosis. So they're of East and West, and of course, that's stagnation. You don't move up and down. You don't move north and south. You don't ascend by moving east and west. So there was something very clever that Baum put in there. But, you know, when Dorothy gets home at the end, she's much more conscious. She's much more aware. She's had this wonderful adventure, and she's come to know herself. And the farmhands don't really understand it. They can't really quite figure it out. They think she's, you know, talking silly or whatever. But she's wiser, she's better, she knows more. And it's because she's had this journey into Gnosticism. She's going on this mystery school tradition travel where she's gone to this foreign land. She's encountered these different entities and just come to know herself. She's walked on the golden path of religion. She's encountered the demiurge. And this is akin to what Lewis Carroll did in the Alice right. in Wonderland. It's almost the same story. So,
right. Who knew all that was in there? I was, just as a child, I just remembered being absolutely frightened by the flying monkeys. But what can you tell me about the supposed connection between the Wizard of Oz and MK Ultra? Because so many alleged mind control victims have talked about the use of that movie as some sort of triggering mechanism or entrainment. Have you heard about that, and what can you tell me about it?
Yeah, I've heard this. I've heard that in MKUltra, this is some sort of program mechanism that subjects are first forced to watch over and over again, is the Wizard of Oz. I've heard this story as well. You know, I'm fully aware of it. I've never been able to fully substantiate it, of course. But no, you know, that there are, I'm not sure what the exact purpose of watching it is over and over again, perhaps some sort of indoctrination, perhaps some sort of form of mind control. We know that when it comes to these Manchurian candidates, they seem to, you know, there are these tip-off things or these triggers that you described. The one that I guess is probably the most well-known of them all, I mean, you see this in the movie, The Manchurian Candidate, where in the very first one, it was in the 1960s, the trigger is the playing card, the Queen of Diamonds. And then we know later on with Reagan and Lenin, when they were shot, Lenin was assassinated, Reagan survived. The assassination of Lenin and Reagan were just a couple months apart. Let's see, Lenin was in December of 1980, Reagan was in March of 1981. The assassins were both reading the same book, which was The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. They both were obsessed with it. So, you know, that seems to have been whatever it was, the trigger incident, event occurred in that book but it was something embedded in that book that was perhaps part of some sort of MK Ultra deeper mind control programming. I've heard the story about the Wizard of Oz, but I can't really pin it down as to, you know, what exactly is in there that is the trigger event, as it were.
What about the use of the subtext for indoctrination, or even a more subtle form of mind control? I mean, do you get into that at all? Is that something that you are wary of or pay attention to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I talk in my books about how movies can be prophetic, and is this intentional, or is this it's really hard to pin it down, because, you know, is it intentional, then how do they know? Or is this some sort of like collective unconscious, what Jung theorized, what Plato talked about with the theory of forms working in reverse? When the movie's far away from the event, that I'm not as interested in. But when the event, when the movie is close to the event, that's very interesting to me. You know, certainly with the buildup of 9/11, we have movies like The Matrix, where the passport expires on September 11, 2001. We have the Patriot movie with Mel Gibson, which was released in the summer of 2000, where at the very beginning he's making a chair. He sits on the chair and he collapses. And before he did it, he weighs it and weighs 9 pounds, 11 ounces. I mean, you have some of the stuff with Donald Trump. The lead up with Trump is fascinating. Back in the 1950s, although it is far removed, I can't help but not talk about it, where there was a TV show called Trackdown, where a character came on the show named Trump, and all he wanted to do was build walls to save people. Fascinating. You have Donald Trump making a TV show, a TV commercial in 2010 for Serta mattresses, where he's counting sheep, and the two sheep outside his door are 11 and 9, November 9th, the day he won the presidency. That symbolism repeats in a movie 20 years earlier called Gremlins 2, where a Donald Trump analog named Daniel Clamp is approached by two news reporters, and the numbers on their mics are 11 and 9, November 9th. Fascinating. And then you have the Lego movie, which came out in 2014, President Business, which is another Donald Trump analog. Watch the Lego movie. This is very prophetic, predictive programming, where the President Business, all he wants to do is build walls around the different Lego worlds. And he actually refers in the Lego movie to his detractors as snowflakes, of all things. So, I mean, go figure. It's fascinating, this, to me, and it is something that I'm wary of, and I do pay attention to it. I just have trouble explaining it. I mean, it's definitely occurring. I'm not saying it isn't, but is it intentional, or is it some sort of psychological event horizon happening where the human being, being an artistic creature and creating and making films, which is an artistic endeavor eventually, is somehow this tapping into some sort of higher consciousness, and these events are being put into movies almost on a subconscious level. It's something I talk about. I talk about it in the book. Is it predictive programming, or is it this reverse psychology almost of the collective unconscious, which Jung talked about, which Plato, the Greek philosopher, talks about? Very fascinating to me, but it's definitely occurring, no doubt.
Well, the other disturbing example would be the Batman movie that came out, and the reference to Sandy Hook, of course.
Right. You have that. And then the ones with 9/11, some of these are really disturbing. The two that are really just uncanny is you had the Simpsons episode called Homer Simpson versus New York City, where, you know, this is the one we've all seen, where Bart waves the money in front of the magazine, which says 9/11 on it. What people aren't realizing is, and this hasn't really been talked about and fleshed out, I'm talking about it in Cinema Symbolism 3, which is what I'm working on now, is the date of that episode is actually September 21st, 1997. I mean, it's almost to the day of 9/11. I mean, literally. And then what's interesting, Richard, is the Simpson episode is 1997. Then 2 years later, to that exact date, you had Fight Club come out, September 21st, 1999, which is another 9/11 movie. I mean, you have Tyler Durden referring to the collapsing buildings as Ground Zero. You have the Operation Latte Thunder, where they destroy the sphere. That's an obvious reference to the sphere, formerly in between the World Trade Center towers and the plaza. That movie was released on September 21st, 1999, 2 years after the Simpson episode and 2 years before the actual event, again, almost to the day of 9/11. I mean, that just can't be, I mean, that is just so synchronistic, so timed out. I mean, it's almost impossible to reconcile. I mean, I try to, you know, I talk about it in my books, but can I come on and give you a definitive answer? No, I suspect no one can, just because it's so uncanny.
Yes, I mean, the alternative is, if it's not just happenstance,
no, I agree.
Or it's part of this, you know, this Jungian collective unconscious. The third alternative is, of course, the most disturbing, and that is that it is deliberate predictive programming, which means that the exec producers or whomever working on the show has some foreknowledge of these horrific events. And that is almost, it's just almost too cynical and sinister to even contemplate.
I agree with you, but the problem is we have to talk about it. I mean, I agree. I totally agree. Is it some sort of collective unconsciousness at work where, you know, the theory of forms, where these symbols are inherited? Can they also be predictive? Or is it some sort of foreknowledge of some kind? I mean, it's definitely disturbing to talk about. I mean, there are other examples of it with 9/11. I mean, we talked about the Donald Trump stuff is interesting. We talked about one that no one knows about that gets left off is, I can't remember the year, I believe it's 79 or 78. There was a movie that was released called The China Syndrome.
Yes.
Which is about a nuclear reactor melting down.
Yes, Michael Douglas and Jack Lemmon, 1975.
Right, that was released, and then 2 weeks later was Three Mile Island, 2 weeks later. So that's another fascinating one that seems to get left off. So there are instances of this. I mean, it's not a one-time thing, but, I mean, can I come on? I mean, so, you know, they definitely have knowledge of this. No, I mean, I don't think anyone can. As a lawyer, I could only present the evidence, but it is something that is very disturbing. But I think it's worth talking about. It is definitely worthy of discussion because it happened. It is a documentable event. But can I fully explain it? No, I can't. You know, like you said, the alternative is that someone has foreknowledge of this, and that seems, you know, almost impossible, but that may be something we're just left to deal with.
We've got about 2 minutes before we break here at the bottom of the hour, but let's just start this conversation. We'll continue on. And what do you mean by occult casting?
Oh, absolutely. This is something that I first talked about in the first movie book, and I talked about it in the second. This is where an actor or an actress is brought in to play a specific part in a movie, and they're relying on their cultural valences from a previous film to affect your subconscious mind, to conjure in your subconscious mind an earlier performance and embed that performance and its surrounding mythology into the current film. An example of this, there are several of them. When I first started researching this and started noticing it, I thought it was somewhat of an isolated event. I do see it a little more and more now. And these guys are very clever with this.
We'll get to an example, Robert, when we come back. And we'll also open up the phone lines, questions and comments, as we discuss cinema symbolism with Robert Sullivan. Hey, welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. You've probably seen this effect, and perhaps you're even a victim of it. You feel alienated from mainstream culture, and you want to make a statement that you're not part of it. You think about wearing different clothes, experimenting with a new hairstyle, or even trying unconventional makeup and grooming products. And yet, when you finally reveal your new hipster look to the world, it turns out you're not alone. Millions of others have made exactly the same choices. Indeed, you all look more or less identical, the exact opposite of the countercultural statement you wanted to achieve. This is the hipster effect, the counterintuitive phenomenon in which people who oppose mainstream culture all end up looking the same. It's so true. Similar effects occur among investors and in other areas of the social sciences. How does this kind of synchronization occur? Is it inevitable in modern society? And are there ways for people to genuinely differentiate themselves from the masses? You can read all about it in the In the News section, where Sean Latasseur has posted that up at coasttocoastam.com. Your questions and comments for Robert W. Sullivan as we continue to delve into cinema symbolism right here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, before we get to the phone lines, and they are full, absolutely full, let's just follow up on a point before the break. We were talking about occult casting, and just very briefly explain what that means, and then you were going to give us an example.
Right, right. This is where they use a certain actor or actress to bring into a new film their cultural valences from, you know, this cultural baggage they bring from earlier films. It's more than typecasting. It's going for something very specific. One of the best examples I can give is Max von Sydow in the recent Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, where he plays this hermit living on this desert planet, and he gives the relic to the guy, and then he takes off, and then the First Order comes down, and he gets killed by Kylo Ren. That scene, by the casting of von Sydow, that is designed intentionally by the filmmakers to conjure two other images of von Sydow movies. The first is, of course, The Exorcist, where he confronts the evil statue out in the desert. It's the same imagery, where von Sydow plays the hermit, he plays the Jesuit, and he's out in the desert, and then he goes around, and then he sees the statue. What this is conveying to your subconscious mind is that the First Order and Kylo Ren have the demonism of Pazuzu. And then it has another movie, which is Dune, by Frank Herbert, directed by David Lynch, where it's the same imagery, where the von Sydow character is a hermit living on the desert planet, and he confronts the Harkonnens, Baron Harkonnen. So the whole idea of casting von Sydow in this very minor and significant part, which could have been played by anybody, what that is designed by the filmmakers to do is to conjure, it's really a form of sorcery. It's one of the closest things to modern day sorcery you'll find is that is intentionally being done. That casting of von Sydow is designed to conjure, and that's the right word to use, to conjure in your subconscious mind The Exorcist and Dune. And what it's doing is it's embedding the brutality of the Harkonnen and the demonism of Pazuzu into the First Order and Kylo Ren. It's very clever. And these filmmakers, they're expert with it. And it's not all actors and actresses, of course, but occasionally you will find a very sophisticated filmmaker who will cast somebody, and it's intentionally designed that this actor will bring some sort of cultural baggage very subtly into this new film that's designed to conjure something in your subconscious mind.
All right, let's dive into the phone calls. And on the wildcard line, Carlos is checking in from Carson, California. Carlos, good evening, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, good evening. Fascinating program, really interesting. A question for Robert. In many movies, I see the number 11 displayed, even by either by the number itself or by its summation, 47, 38, 4 plus 7 equals 11, 38 equals 3, the number 38, 3 plus 8 equals 11. And I saw that in many different movies, particularly in the one of the movies that Tom Cruise made, where there's a wagon. And the wagon of the train number is like 47, and then the room number, the suite number where he's staying is like 38. So it's all giving number 11. And I've been so perplexed by this number. Robert, do you know what the number 11 signifies? As we see the number 11 displayed extensively in our 9/11 by the 110 floors in the...
All right, Robert, let's get Robert in here then. Robert, the number 11, what does it mean?
Well, it could mean, I will say this, I'd have to see the movie and I'd have to see the context it's presented in, because it may mean one thing in one movie and something else in another movie, but numbers are certainly something that these filmmakers use to convey an esoteric meaning, but it really depends on the context of how it's presented. I mean, for example, the number 88 in Back to the Future has a occult meaning. The same number 88 in The Exorcist has a occult meaning, but it's different. So it just depends. I have to see the context as it was presented in to really give you a better answer. But I will just say that numbers are used extensively by filmmakers to convey esoteric meaning, and it's one of their best devices, because a number generally doesn't lie. So
I would just have to see, you know, see the movie and see its overall context to be able to give you a better definitive answer. But I will say the numbers are definitely used in movies to convey occult themes, no question about it.
Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Carl is waiting impatiently. Carl, welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard and Robert. How are you doing?
Well, good morning.
Good, good. Just two quick things. I don't know if Robert had ever heard, or you had ever heard several years ago. I love The Wizard of Oz, one of my favorite movies, by the way, 1939, where it's synced. You can sync it up with Dark Side of the Moon. When the lion roars, you start the album, and there's certain events that happen in the movie that are synced with the music. Had he ever heard anything about that?
Yes, I have. I have heard about it. I've never tried it. I am familiar with that, with the Pink Floyd album. The only thing I've heard people tell me that it works perfectly. I've had other people tell me it doesn't really work at all. I've never tried it myself, but I have heard of it.
I interviewed Alan Parsons several months ago on Coast, and he, of course, was the sound engineer on Dark Side of the Moon, and he kind of scoffed at the idea, laughed. He said he did try it, and he said there was a couple of things that kind of synced up quite nicely, but the rest of it he thought was unimpressive. He said, try this experiment. First of all, he said it was not intentional. We didn't do that on purpose. He said, but if you try that with just about any album and any movie, you'll find areas or moments that kind of overlap, where there's kind of synchronous events, which it would be an interesting experiment. But Alan Parsons went on record on this program saying that it was not done intentionally. Let's say hi to Nyad in New York. Good morning, Nyad.
Hey, Richard, and Rob, Mayad with an M.
My apologies, Mayad. Okay.
No problem. The goddess of truth, justice, and right. I have a three-parter, and then I'd like to stay online for the third part in case she's not familiar with what I'm bringing up. But in terms of Track Down and Gremlin 2, I'd like him to clarify the dates. I actually saw a clip of Track Down on AM Joy, and it was uncanny. I mean, you don't even know how to react when the sheriff of the town is confronting it. Somebody who he's calling Donald and confronting about his wall that over 60% of American people don't want a part of. A lot of people die, and the children seem to have died behind the meter and the wall. But the second part, I want the dates of those two shows. The second part is I'd like to know, I understand you have a very eclectic and seemingly great background for this symbolism in the movies, but I'd like to know what the actual impetus was for you getting involved in that field. The third part concerns the Matrix movies. Are you familiar with the backstory to the Matrix, Robert?
Yes, I am.
I'm talking about Sophia Stewart, a young black woman who actually wrote those movies, presented it to those brothers. They stole the movies, and I tell you, she must be so brilliant because she's not an attorney, but she managed to study law to the extent that she was successful with her lawsuits. And I don't know the details of that, but an attorney in New York told me that she had been successful, so I take her word for it. But is that the part of the backstory that you know about Sophia Stewart and her actually having written those movies?
Well, the Matrix movies I analyzed in the first book, I am familiar with the Sophia Stewart story, but I've never been able to corroborate it one way or the other, but I am familiar with it.
Please follow it, because an attorney a few months ago told me she had been successful. I heard her on the air a few times on different radio programs, but please add that to the mix, and I'll listen if you got my questions about the dates of those, the Track Down and the Gremlin 2, and about the impotence. I'll listen over the air, and I look forward to your next appearance telling us about who Sophia Stewart was and what that fuller story is. Thank you so much.
All right, Maida, thank you. So Track Down, this was the American TV show from the late 50s, and one of the episodes featured a character named Trump who came into this Western town promising to build a wall.
Correct. And then there was the Gremlins 2, which is, there's a character in Gremlins 2. This was with Trump being, like, prophetic. This was a movie, I think it was released in 1990 or 91. It's the sequel to Gremlins, naturally. And it's a character named Daniel Clamp. And it's a Trump analog. And he has Clamp Tower. It's in Manhattan. And there's a scene in it where Clamp, it's a character played by John Glover. And he's being interviewed, and there's two microphones. The news reporters put microphones in front of his faces, in front of his face, excuse me. And the number on the microphones is 11, and one's 11 and one's 9, which is November 9th, again, the date that he became president or won the popular, or won the Electoral College vote, I guess is the correct way to say it. And the other question she asked, that's in Gremlins 2, and the other question I believe she asked was, am I impetus for getting involved with this? With the movies, it was my first book that I wrote was called The Royal Arch of Enoch, and this was really a product of 20 years of research investigating the esoteric, the occult, the Book of Enoch, the Ethiopian text, and this is a book about Freemasonry. I am a Freemason, as Richard said at the very beginning of the show, and this book involves a lot of occult symbolism, the Masonic architecture, the Masonic designs of cities, things of that nature, the Masonic history of the United States. Keep it short because I know we're running out of time. But in the final chapter of that book, I delved into some of the Masonic Gnostic symbolism in movies such as National Treasure, the second National Treasure movie, movies like Excalibur, which is a solar allegory. And as I was doing this, I was noticing this symbolism in other movies such as like The Matrix, which is the Gnostic religion or film, which is the Valentinian thread. And movies like Fight Club, which also has a Gnostic element in it, Wizard of Oz, which we talked about earlier. So I wanted to talk about this more. So the final chapter of the Royal Arch of Enoch book was me talking about some of the Masonic symbolism in film, and I just carried this forward, but I broadened the scope, talking about the occult, Gnosticism, comparative religion, the esoteric in movies, and I produced Cinema Symbolism, which was the first book, then I did Cinema Symbolism 2, they're out right now, and I'm actually writing Cinema Symbolism 3 as we speak.
And the she was also looking for the original air date. I have it here for the Trump episode in the series Track Down. That aired in season 1. It was episode 30. It was called The End of the World. And the air date, I don't know if this is significant, but it was May 9th, 1958. So there you go, Maida. Let's see if we can squeeze quickly. John is east of the Rockies in Virginia Beach. Go ahead, John. Good morning.
Yes, Richard, Robert, thank you very much for taking my call.
We'll have to make it quickly, John, because we just have a few minutes here.
Yeah, I just want to ask Robert, how far back does he go to review a movie? I know you talked about The Wizard of Oz, but I think some of the movies made in the late 30s and late 40s are probably some of the best movies Hollywood ever produced. And I just want to know how far back does he go?
I think the question was, how far back does symbolism go? You can go back to the very beginning of Hollywood. Two of the movies that I'm talking about in Cinema Symbolism 3 are two of the very first movies ever made, Metropolis by Fritz Lang and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So, you will find esoteric symbolism embedded in movies from day one, essentially.
All right. Thank you for the call. And Robert, thank you for these 2 hours. There's so much to discuss, so many movies. We look forward to Cinema Symbolism 3. What's the projected publishing date?
I'm working on that now. I hope to have it done probably over the summer. So maybe at the end of this year, early next year. Inevitably, it takes a little longer than you first anticipate. I speak from experience. So hopefully it'll be done probably over the summer. Maybe Christmas at the earliest of this year, 2019, if not early next year, hopefully.
And leave us with a website.
My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV, and that is my website, www.robertwsullivan.com. and then the letter I, the letter V for the fourth, robertwsullivaniv.com.
Thank you, Robert. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Richard.
When we come back, Maria Wheatley will unravel the mystery of Stonehenge.